Jeremiah 48. Now, Lord willing, we'll wrap up Jeremiah next week. Provided I can get through this this week. The chapters get long. In a number of the minor prophets, you have prophecies that deal with the nations, the different nations that are usually about Israel. Some of them are not right adjacent. Some of them are nations that might be a little ways away, and one of them we're going to be looking at here tonight. But you have these nations in the surrounding areas, and there's prophecies that that relate to them. And understand that almost without exception, and I say almost because there might be something I'm not thinking of, but almost without exception, if a nation has a prophecy dealing with it in the Bible, it's a nation that has direct interaction with Israel, either in the past, during the era that the Bible was written in, or in the future when we're talking about the tribulation and the kingdom era. All right? During this swath of time, the church age between Pentecost and the rapture of the church, we don't have anything in the Old Testament that deals with that period of time except one little item, just one, and that has to do with the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Other than that, there is nothing that deals with that period of time. It's as if it doesn't exist as far as the Old Testament is concerned. So these nations will be are going to have something in conjunction with Israel. The first one, and this is kind of interesting, this is the longest prophecy regarding the nation of Moab in the Bible. There's a bunch of different prophecies regarding Moab throughout the Old Testament. This is by far the longest one. The entire chapter, 47 verses of chapter 48 devoted to the nation of Moab. Now, I forgot to do this. I knew I was going to forget something. Map. Okay, I'll do better this time. I'll try to do better anyway. All right, so we got this, and we're going to do that, and then, all right, I'm going to make the, all right, Sea of Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea, Jerusalem, okay? Now, we talked a little bit about the Philistines last week. We dealt with Egypt last week. Those are the two we talked about last week. Our prophecies here go, by and large, from southwest to northeast. There's a couple of bumps in the road as far as that's concerned, but generally speaking, that's the case. What we're looking at tonight are the nations that are to the east, and a number of them are immediately adjacent to Israel. You have a nation that occupied this area of land, and it's sort of circular because the borders are always a little iffy, especially on the east, because this fades out to extreme desert, and so the population decreased. You have the nation of Ammon right there. Now down here, swinging over here and touching the Dead Sea, and then across over is the nation of Moab, and then south of Moab, adjoining it, is the nation of Edom. All right? Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Now, we're going to start with Moab, the one in between. Who are the Moabites? Where did they come from? Let's get a little background here, because this is going to be important. This is relevant. Who are the Moabites? Where did they come from? They came from Moab. There's a town in Utah called Moab. Maybe they're from Utah. All right, I want you to go to Genesis, chapter 19. Genesis, chapter 19, we have the angels that show up and deliver Lot and his family, or a portion of his family, from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot's wife turned back and, it says, became a pillar of salt. I believe that she was probably encrusted with the salts from the explosions and so on that took place there. Lot is left with his two young daughters, and for all they know, let's give them a little tiny bit of argument here, for all they know, that they're the only people left on the earth. And they end up living in a cave, and both the girls end up getting their dad drunk on successive nights and have physical relations with their dad and become pregnant from their father. There's incest going on here. And the result of that there is at the end of chapter 19. And it says, and the firstborn, verse 37, bare a son and called his name Moab. the same as the father of the Moabites unto this day. And the younger, she also bare a son, and called his name Ben-Ammi, the same as the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. So the Moabites and the Ammonites are descended from Lot. They are descended from Lot. They have a connection, a physical connection with Israel. They're related to Abraham. They are not descended from Abraham, but they're related. This might explain also why all three of these peoples practice circumcision. So you get understand where the Ammonites are descended from Lot, the Moabites are descended from Lot. Now what about the Edomites? Where did they come from?
Esau.
Remember you had Abraham had Ishmael, who was not the son of promise. Then he had Isaac, who was the son of promise. Then he got married again because Sarah had died. Married a woman named Keturah, and he had, I think, another 7 or 8 kids by Keturah. But God had repeatedly promised that the son of promise was the one was Isaac, the only son of Sarah. All the rest of them were children of his concubines, which would be a slave wife. All right. Isaac has a wife named Rebekah. They're married for 20 years. There's no kids. Problem here. All right. Plus, God had said that the promise of Abraham is going to come through Isaac. So Isaac knows he's got to have kids. And so he prays. And they come back with a vengeance. She has twins. And they are not identical twins. They are very, very different in their appearance. They are very, very different in their disposition. And one of them is Jacob, whose name is later changed to Israel. And he's the one that fathered the 12 tribes. This is why you have the children of Israel being the nation of Israel. All right, Edom is a word that means red. Esau also means, in part, red. And he settled in this area here where the stones are also red. If you've ever seen pictures of Petra, remember here seeing pictures of Petra? Okay, never. All right, Petra was one of the cities of the ancient Edomites. Now, the carvings and all the beautiful stuff that you see today was done by people that came in there later, but that was originally inhabited by the Edomites. All right, so these folks are all related to Israel, but by the time Israel comes up out of the land of Egypt, all three of these nations are idolatrous. They had forsaken the truth that they had been taught in their youth. And by succeeding generations, Israel did the same thing, but Israel kept getting yanked back. These folks were thoroughly enmeshed in idolatry. And they were always, when Moses brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, they're wandering around the wilderness and they come through here, God said, don't mess with these three nations. I have given them their allotted piece of turf. You are not to conquer these people. Now, Israel conquered the people that lived here. You had the Amorites that lived here, and then you had another group of Amorites that lived here, and Israel conquered both of those, and that's why you had Jews living on the east side of Jordan. This area up here is Gilead. All right? So, one of the problems you're going to have, well, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So you have the Moabites. Now, what is the... Moab had an interesting situation as far as the climate is concerned. It's still that way to some extent today. Climate does change a little bit. It's actually drier here than it was 2,000-3,000 years ago. Today it is. But Moab, even though they are east over there, even though they're east of the Dead Sea, actually gets rain. It's kind of an oddball thing. And the reason they get, you're familiar with rain shadows and stuff? You got this thing over here on the peninsula with, you go driving along, you go through Port Townsend, it's wet and everything, and then you come to Squim, and it looks like California, and then you drive a few more miles, and you're in Port Angeles, and it's green again. All right, we have a rain shadow up in that area. You get rain shadows different parts of the world where you have high mountains, and it sucks all the rain out of it, and then the area behind it gets very little rainfall. Dead Sea. Lowest spot on earth. Well over 1,000, I think it's around 1,300 feet below sea level. Very, very, very low. Hot, dry, sunny, and yet the people who live there aren't that many people live there, but the people who live there never get skin cancer because there's so much atmosphere it filters out all the bad stuff. And along the eastern or the western side of the Dead Sea, they only get about 6 inches of rain a year, 6 to 8 inches of rain a year. It's a very dry place. That's where Masada is and some of those other places. When you come over here to the east side of the Dead Sea, all of a sudden the landscape goes like this. Whew! Goes way, way up very fast. And you end up with a plateau here that's about 3,000 feet in elevation. So between the surface of the Dead Sea and this area here, you've got almost a 4,000 foot shift. Okay? As the clouds come across here, when they hit this, what do? It rains. Now, it's not rain like here, but it's rainy enough so they can actually grow crops there. And we're going to see a couple of things that Moab was famous for at that time. So you get the basic idea. They're on a plateau, which is also good protection. If you're an invading army and you come along and all of a sudden you're looking up at these cliffs and there's only so many winding switchback roads to get up there, and the folks that are up there, you know, that's great defense. If you're trying to get up on that plateau and you've got to take the switchback road up there, the people up there are throwing rocks at you and shooting arrows down at you and everything else. It's very hard to get up there with a big army. All right. So Moab had a benefit that the surrounding nations, by and large, didn't have. And that was, although they had been subjugated, where they had to pay tribute, they had never been wiped out. They had never been deported. They had always been there and living their lifestyle and doing what they had. They had never been overwhelmed by an invading force. All right, since they had become a nation. Again, they had been subjugated. They'd had to pay tribute, sometimes to Israel, sometimes to Assyria, some other things. But they had never been overwhelmed and wiped out or conquered in the regular sense of the thing. They've been a fairly secure situation because of where they are and what the countryside is like, the topography. Okay, back to Jeremiah. So you got a little background here. They're idolaters. They're in a secure place. They get enough rainfall, they can grow crops. They're a little bit isolated, but they do have some commerce going around with the surrounding nations. And they hated Israel. And sometimes they hated the Edomites, and sometimes they hated the Ammonites. These guys always fought against each other because you can't expand to the west because you got the Dead Sea in the way. I can't expand to the east because there's desert. And so if I want to expand, it's going to be at the expense of either Israel, Ammon, or Edom. Okay, so there's always wars going on. Okay, verse 1. Against Moab, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, woe unto Nebo. And he's going to list, in this prophecy, there's over 20 cities listed. I'm not going to spend a lot of time showing you where these things were and all this other stuff. Some of them, they have no idea. This is the only mention anywhere in the Bible or out where a lot of these places are mentioned. There's about four or five of them, they have a good idea where they are. The rest of it's like, I don't know, it's some city in Moab. So there's going to be a long list of cities here in the first 10 verses. And it says there in verse 2, there shall no more be praise of Moab in Heshbon. They have devised evil against it. Come, let us cut it off from being a nation. Also, thou shalt be cut down, O Madmen. That's another city. I always got a kick out of reading that one because of how it's spelled. The sword shall pursue thee. All right, Heshbon. Let's talk about that for just a moment. Heshbon is a city that is about here. It's in the former Israelite territory. This had been conquered by other people and the Jews deported, but then former Israelite territory. That'd been part of the tribe of Reuben. And this is where Nebuchadnezzar's army camped to plan their invasion of Moab. So when he says here, Moab, they have devised evil against it, that's where they hatched their plans. There in verse 2, it hatched their plans as far as Nebuchadnezzar's invasion of Moab. It has that big long list of cities that are going to be destroyed and the weeping and the lamentation and so on that goes with that. Let's drop down to verse 11. Because it just says, you know, this city is going to be weeping and this one's going to be destroyed and blah, blah, blah. It just goes down the list. You get a good idea of what is going to happen. Now remember, this nation had never been overwhelmed before. They had been there for 1,000 years in this situation. Very, very secure. Very unusual for that period of time. But you have to understand, this is this one and to some extent Edom have very unusual circumstances as far as the topography is concerned, as far as their location is concerned. They are the only nations in this whole region that have this kind of a setup where the physical landscape is actually a great protection. Other than that, you might have a river, or you might just have, okay, it's kind of like going from Puyallup to Sumner. Where does Puyallup stop and Sumner start? Well, it's this street here. We have a lot of that around here. Any metro areas that way. It was sometimes that way with the nations here. Where's the frontier? Well, let's see. The last agreement was, Brother Leo's farm here is Israel, and Brother Tim's farm over here is Moab. And you just it shifts around depending on who's more powerful and so on. Oh yeah, last year I had to pay taxes in Israel. This year I had to pay taxes in Moab. It was kind of that way. So you're going to have all these cities destroyed and so on. And then here's the downfall. They were very arrogant. They were very proud of their circumstances. They thought that they were invincible. The Jews had, to some extent, the same thing as far as the city of Jerusalem was concerned. We're invincible. Why did the Jews think that Jerusalem was invincible? Because the temple's here. This is where God is. God cannot allow Jerusalem to be sacked. He cannot be destroyed because the temple is here. Now, there's no Bible promises that way. The temple had become something of a rabbit's foot for them. Just like the Ark of the Covenant was there in 1 Samuel, where you had Hophni and Phinehas take it out to battle, because after all, if we got the Ark with us, we're invincible. And guess what happened? The Philistines took the Ark. Sometimes they have this rabbit's foot mentality. And the Moabites had the same thing. Because their circumstances were very secure, they were rather arrogant in their situation. It says there in verse 11, Moab hath been at ease from his youth, the security of their circumstances. He hath settled on his lees. Now, in the next few verses, he's going to use this picture. It's kind of, in the culture of the time, it was very simple. How many of you, looking out here, you probably do, how many know what a croc is? And I don't mean like, okay, you know what a croc. Okay, it's a round pot, sort of. They used to store things in on the farm. You could fill it with, I remember seeing them with rock salt in them, or you could store grain, or what's that? Okay, all kinds of different things. You'll see them with all different, and most of these days, you don't see them with the lids too much anymore. Those end up getting broken or lost, but they used to come with a lid and stuff. Again, keep pickles, and okay, you get different things in them. And you still see them at antique stores. You can still buy them. They still make them. Although they're harder to find than they used to be. They used to be everywhere. My dad's house, there's a bunch of them laying around. One of those things I'd love to get out here, but 3,000 miles, a little far. All right, so they grew a lot of grapes in Moab. Been to California, see the rows of vineyards and stuff. They had a similar type of thing in Moab. And they would gather the grapes, and of course they would stomp on the grapes and make their grape juice. And then they would take the juice and put it in basically crocks. Okay, now understand that when we make wine. Anybody take the dinner trainer or everything and been to a winery or seen how that's done? Not that I drink it, but it's kind of interesting to watch, right? They take it, they put it in a bottle, and then put the cork in there, and it ferments to a certain extent. And by the way, wine, if it gets super duper old, what happens to it? Turns to vinegar. Sorry, you only have a window of time when it's actually got alcohol in it. And it has to be corked, otherwise it goes to vinegar, and you just have a real short window when it's got alcohol in it. All right. Back in Bible times, they weren't, by and large, having alcoholic wine. Alcoholic wine was used, and people drank it to get drunk and stuff like that, but it could only be used in that short window. They didn't have, in the Middle East, they didn't have the bottles with the corks and stuff in them. All right. They were making a syrup and a thicker thing. Why is it that honey doesn't mold? Why? Moisture content's too low and sugar content's too high. Why is it that if you have your Torani syrups for making your lattes and stuff like that, you don't have to refrigerate it after it's open? Same reason. Moisture content is too low for the sugar content. Bacteria can't live in it, can't mold. Yeah. Okay. And also, it's sometimes what you put on it. It's not just the stuff by itself. right. So what they would do in their processing grape juice is they would take the juice, they put it in a crock, and they would let it settle. You know, because it's got all this, you know, it's kind of like unfiltered apple juice and stuff. You know, it's kind of opaque. And over a period of time, it would settle. Now, also, it's fermenting and it's dehydrating. And they would pour off the juice into another crock, watching the grit and stuff in the bottom, making sure that they didn't pour off. Okay, the lees, what it says here, it says there in verse, has been at Eve, he has settled on his lees. The lees is the crud that's in the bottom of the crock. All right? He settled on his lees and hath not been emptied from vessel to vessel, pouring off so that you can get rid of the stuff that's in the bottom. And that way, by the way, after they were all done, they would have a thick, sugary stuff that was similar to like your Torani syrup and stuff like that, and they would store that. And when they mixed their wine, it was taking, just like you make soda today, you mix the syrup with water, and that's what they drink. Now, if you mix it just right and it's got the right bacteria, that stuff can still ferment too. All right, so they could get fermented wine, but a lot of your wine in your Old Testament was not fermented wine. Just because it says wine does not demand that we're dealing with alcohol. Okay, so Moab was a wine-producing nation. They exported it. They did a lot of it on their own, but they exported it as well. And it says he has settled on his lees. He's not been processed. He has become complacent. And therefore his taste has remained in him. His scent is not changed. We have not processed it. We have not making just the plain grape juice, and we've allowed the stuff to stand, and it's not been filtered and purified and made into what we, the end product that we want. And because of that, therefore the days come, saith the Lord, that I will send unto him wanderers, and they shall cause him to wander, and shall empty his vessels, tip them over, and break their bottles, break the crocks. The whole thing, they'll break the whole thing, smash the whole thing. And it says, Moab shall be ashamed of Chemosh. Chemosh was the national deity. Just like Marduk was the main deity for Babylon, Chemosh was the main deity for the Moabites. And it says, they will be ashamed of Chemosh as the house of Israel was ashamed of Bethel, their confidence. What was Bethel? What's the significance of Bethel? And it tells the house of Israel, northern kingdom. Okay, the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Remember, he set up the altar. These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Bethel is just a few miles north of Jerusalem, right there. And so what he did that very deliberately so the people would stop in Bethel instead of going on to Jerusalem for pilgrimage. And he built an altar there, and then he also set up what? A golden calf. Exactly the same thing you had in Exodus 32. All right? These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. So they're worshiping the golden calf in the name of the Lord. They're mixing paganism with true religion. That has always gone on. Frankly, that's what Roman Catholicism is. All right? And these folks in the north were putting their confidence in the national worship, the national shrine. They had another one up here in Dan. Same thing. Two golden calves, one up here and one down here. And they were saying, our God will save us. But it was a lie because they were worshiping a lie in the first place. And Chemosh, an idol, a block of stone, was the confidence of Moab. And their block of stone did not deliver them. And so they were ashamed of Chemosh. And then verse 14, they had a confidence in their army. They may have had a great army, but understand we're also not dealing with a super big country here. It says, how shall ye say, we are mighty and strong men for war. We can handle this. Well, it doesn't matter if I've got the best of the best. If I've got, you know, 5,000 Green Berets. 5,000 Green Berets or 5,000 Navy SEALs. Or 5,000 of each. Okay, we got some top-notch guys. And I put them out against 100,000 guys with tanks and bazookas. It doesn't matter how well trained and how good my soldiers are, they're going to be overwhelmed. All right? You've got the Chaldeans coming with all their allies. This huge wave coming down on this little nation here. And it doesn't matter how good their soldiers are, it isn't going to make any difference. So they have all this confidence, but their confidence it's that secure. Because what's going to happen, you have in the balance of the next little section there, verses 15 through 19, the rest of it is all about mourning and lamentation. Oh, woe is us. We've been destroyed. Oh, our men have been killed. Oh, our cities have been destroyed. Oh, our economy is ruined. Oh, my children have been sold off to slavery. Oh, this. And here, just a few months before, what was their security? Well, Chemosh, our God, we got a great army, and we're in this natural fortress. We're good to go. We haven't been invaded, overwhelmed in 1,000 years. So we're safe. We're secure. But it was a misplaced confidence. And after it's all done, they just look back and everything they had put their confidence in turned out to be a false hope. And the balance is spent in mourning and lamentation. And then you have a list again of cities, verses 20 through 24. Verse 25, the horn of Moab is broken off, his arm is broken, saith the Lord. All right, you'll see the idea of a horn a number of times in the Old Testament. What is that in reference to? Okay, it's not that kind of horn. Okay, it's talking about this kind of horn. When I was a kid on the farm, if we had a bull that we wanted to keep, we would put him in a stanchion, and this is how primitive we were, and my dad would get out his little torch, you know, and light it, and then we'd get in there, and we'd burn the base of that horn, and that thing would be jumping around for a little while and kill the nerve, and for the rest of his life, he would just have little round knobs on his head, look like doorknobs on the side of his head, all right? He'd never grow any real horns. If we wanted to keep the animal, that's what we did. Now, these days, you get animals that don't have horns in the first place. They don't grow them, period. But we wanted this particular animal. He had horns. We had a cow named Rosie. I still remember this. Rosie was a long Holstein. You know what I'm talking about? It looks like it's got an extra 2 feet of body that shouldn't be there. It's just extra long Holstein. Some of you know what I'm talking about. We had a milking stall, and if Rosie was in there, you milked her from the hallway instead of being in the stall. And Rosie had a rack on her. And Rosie knew she had a rack on her, and she was the dominant animal in the herd. If she wanted to go someplace, she went there. If people were out there and trying to catch her, she would sometimes use her horns and get places. If she saw some green grass on the other side of that electric fence, she'd run a different animal through the electric fence, let them get zapped, and she'd go through the hole that it made. Needless to say, we only kept Rosie for a few years before because she was more trouble than she was worth. But we had a lot of memorable things because of Rosie, and Rosie had that rack on her. An animal's strength is compounded by his horns. I remember there's a rare rhino they had at the San Diego Zoo, and they're trying a breeding program. The female didn't want to be bred, and she had a big horn. And so they got out a chainsaw and cut off her horn so she could be bred because she couldn't defend herself against the fellas after that. So it's the idea of strength. It's the idea of strength is the idea of the horn there. Again, look at verse 25. Okay, the horn of Moab is broken, so the strength has been broken. And then it says, and his arm is broken. If war is afoot and my arm is broken, what does that mean I can't do? I can't wield a sword if my arm is broken. Okay, that imagery is used several other times in Scripture as well, as far as being unable to hold a sword by having the arm broken. So basically this is saying that it doesn't matter how good their military was. Their strength is broken, and their ability to defend themselves has been broken as well. So the strength is broken. And because they have been overwhelmed, because they have been conquered, because the Chaldeans came through and took this people, the nation of Moab is now held instead of being held in some measure of respect by their neighbors, they are now a laughingstock. They are held in derision by those about them. Verse 29, here was their pride. We have heard of the pride of Moab. He's exceedingly proud. His loftiness, his arrogancy, his pride, and the haughtiness of his heart. I know his wrath, saith the Lord, but it shall not be so. His lies shall not so affect it. Therefore will I howl. So it doesn't matter how, what they, their mindset was to begin with. It isn't gonna hold. It's gonna be turned to grief and weeping, verses 30 through 34. And then, and that would be personal. The grief and the weeping is the personal, weeping and crying that you see. And then you have the formal lamentation and mourning where you have the wailing and all this other stuff that goes with the formal mourning and so on in that part of the world, which is, by the way, what you still see. Whenever you see there's a bombing that happens, not in Israel, but in Gaza or something like this, and then you see the footage of all these people going, ah, 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 and they think, good grief, well, it's a horrible situation. That's how they respond. The people you saw yelling and screaming may have actually been hired for the job. They might not even be related to the person who died. All right, they're hired to do this. As a matter of fact, the Jews used to do this, and they still do in certain parts. And the Talmud and so on deals with how many mourners you're supposed to hire and all this other stuff. This was going on in New Testament times when the 12-year-old girl died in the Gospels, and Jesus says, and he comes in, and they were weeping, they were making much ado. And Jesus said, weep not, for the child is not dead but sleepeth. And what immediately did the mourners do? They started mocking him and laughing at him. They weren't really upset. They were hired for this. All right, so the first part is the genuine brokenness of heart, the genuine sorrow, and then the second part is the formal mourning and lamentation, verses 35 through 39. And then verses 40 through 46, dealing with the terror caused by the invader. You know, our nation doesn't, we don't think this way. This is totally, we're that secure nation. Our fortress is called the Atlantic and the Pacific. We are a secure nation. We have never been seriously invaded. And we don't think, you know, but the Canadians are massing on the border. You know, we don't think about that. It's not something it's going to be. At least, you know, we don't think of that kind of thing ever happening. And yet, there's a lot of places in the world where they are. Look at Israel today. They have to be armed to the teeth 24/7. Their mobilization, the guys can go from work to being in uniform on the line in 2 hours. All right? Boom, just like that. They have to be because they are surrounded by enemies, and they have been invaded many, many times. All right? So the idea of the terror of invasion. And in verse 40, it says, for thus saith the Lord, behold, he shall fly as an eagle and shall spread his wings over Moab. Who is he? Doesn't say. Who is he? Who is the he there in verse 40? Who is the main character of this time period? You read Jeremiah, you read Ezekiel, you read Daniel, you read Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the man of the hour as far as world conquest is concerned. So the he is Nebuchadnezzar. He is going to come and overspread Moab. And there is no escape. You know, if you're inside a fortress, these folks are kind of boxed in. When you consider the fact that these guys aren't necessarily real friendly. These guys are not necessarily real friendly. Sometimes there's alliances, but they are strictly, what's the word I'm looking for? Expediencies. Yeah, we're going to get together with the Moabites, but keep your eyes open. Okay, because you never know how long this is going to be before they turn on us. But right now we've got an agreement to deal with this issue, but day after tomorrow, all things are off. So if you're here and you've got the Chaldeans invading, where are you going to go? We can run down to Moab, or to Edom rather. These guys are slave traders. They might stop us, imprison us, and sell us off to Egypt. If we go to Ammon, well, let's see, Nebuchadnezzar has just invaded Ammon. We're out of luck here. If we go to the east, where are we going? Into the giant sandbox, all right? So there's nothing there, and I got the Dead Sea over on the other side. I might be able to slip through here and go up into Israel, but this area here is a giant sandbox too. And this area here are enemies. So I'm boxed in my fortress. And if they get into my fortress, I'm doomed because I have no place to go. It's like a giant siege. So there's no escape. And then verse 45. They that fled stood under the shadow of Heshbon. So these folks are even heading north. Figuring if I get past the Chaldeans, I can go where they have been. Because after all, they've already been through here. I don't have to worry about them invading where they've already been. It stood under the shadow of Heshbon because of the forest. But a fire shall come out of Heshbon, and a flame from the midst of Sihon, and shall devour the corner of Moab and the crown of the head of the tumultuous ones. It doesn't make any difference. They're not going to be able to escape. There is no hope for the refugees, and the rest will be carried away captive. It says, woe be unto thee, verse 46, woe be unto thee, Moab, the people of Chemosh perisheth. For thy sons are taken captive, thy daughters captives. You're being sold off into slavery. Those who are young enough to be put to work are being sold off into slavery. And yet, here's something very interesting. And to me, verse 47 is the thing that jumps out. And you'll see this a couple of times in this section of Jeremiah. Yet will I bring again the captivity of Moab in the latter days, saith the Lord, thus far as the judgment of Moab. Look at the end of the previous chapter, chapter 46. Let's see. I don't have the outline here in front of me. It has to do with the fact that the Egypt will be restored as well. I can't pick out the exact reference. In chapter 46, in dealing with Egypt, Egypt will have a place in the latter days as well. Moab is going to have a place in the latter days. Now, what happened to the Moabites? After Nebuchadnezzar came in and conquered them, overwhelmed the nation, what happened to the Moabites? Do you hear about Moabites anymore in your Bible? When you get into Ezra and Nehemiah, where you had the captives that had been carried off to Babylon, brought back in, and they're starting to rebuild Jerusalem. There's no walls. They're having to deal with the Samaritans, which are the people up here. They're having to deal with the Ammonites. The Ammonites are still in action at that time. They're having to deal with the Arabs that are from this area here. We know that there were still Philistines at that time. There's no mention of Moabites after this time in the Bible. Now, were there still Moabites? Yes, there were. What happened to them then? Well, their piece of ground, because it is the most fertile and the best piece of real estate in this region, there are other people that wanted it. And because the Moabites had been weakened, their army decimated by Nebuchadnezzar, they never recovered from that. And they weren't able to defend their plateau. And you had a group, the Arabs who lived in this area here, over here, moved in. They're the ones that built Petra. A group of people called Nabataeans. They're the ones that moved in and built Petra. And what happened to the Moabites? Well, they intermingled with the surrounding peoples. And are the descendants of the Moabites still with us today? Are there still people that if they could figure out their pedigree going back 2,500 years, would find out they were Moabites? Yes. But there's nobody on earth today that knows that they're a Moabite. The nation is gone, their language is gone, their culture, everything is gone. They've been assimilated into that melting pot of that region. And that happened before the time of Christ. So Moab is an independent ethnic group, as an independent nation, as a culture and so on, is gone really after the invasion of Nebuchadnezzar. They're done. But God's going to bring them back because it has a purpose for them. In the millennium, you will have Moab. And this isn't the only place where that's mentioned. So you'll have Moab again. All right, chapter 49. I'm not going to be able to get through the whole thing. We're just going to get down through Ammonites and maybe Edom. Okay. Verse 1, the Ammonites. Okay, these are these folks up here. It says, here's the problem. Here's why God has an issue with the Ammonites. Thus saith the Lord, hath Israel no sons? Hath he no heir? Why then doth their king inherit Gad, the Ammonite king? Why do they inherit Gad and his people dwell in the cities? Where was Gad? Gad is one of the tribes of Israel. Where did Gad settle? Gad settled here. Okay? This region right here. You had Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. Remember when, before the children of Israel crossed over Jordan? You had three or two and a half tribes that came to Moses and said, hey, your servants have a lot of cattle, and this country is great for grazing cattle. How about if we get our inheritance over here, and the rest of you guys go across Jordan? And this is in the book of Numbers, and in chapter 32. And Moses says, oh, so you guys are going to stay here and the rest of us are going to have to go fight the Canaanites over there? I don't think so. And they said, well, we will send our soldiers. We'll build our cities here and we'll build pens and stuff like that. And then our wives and our kids and the old timers will stay here and take care of things here. But the army will go with you guys until you guys settle in. And Moses said, okay, if you follow through and do what you said, fine. But if you will not do so, here's the verse, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. That's where that verse comes from. And they fulfilled their pledge. And this region here was settled by the Jewish people. Now, if Ammon is going to expand their territory, they can't go this way because it's desert. By the way, the capital of Ammon was a city called Rabbah. And it's an oasis, lots of water in Rabbah. It's a plateau as well, not quite the same situation as Moab because you don't have the Dead Sea effect, but you still have some rainfall. They still have to be able to grow crops and stuff in Ammon. Rabbah is now called Amman, which is the capital of the country of Jordan today. Okay, large city, still a fair amount of water. The population has grown into the millions, and so now they have to get water from the Jordan, thanks to the Israelis showing them how to do it and so on. All right, one of the benefits of the peace between Israel and Jordan for the time being anyway. All right, so if these guys want to expand, they could fight with Moab, but again, Moab is in this natural fortress. We can swing north here, but this is fairly dry. Plus, you've got the Syrians up here, the Arameans of Damascus, pretty powerful folks. So where else can I go? I can go west. I can take this piece of ground. And there was a lot of wars that were, you go through your Old Testament, there's a lot of wars between the Israelites and the Ammonites. Okay, I can think of two right off the top of my head. Jephthah. Remember Jephthah? The Ammonites had invaded and taken this area. This is in the book of Judges. And there was a war, and the Israelites beat them and sent them back home. When Saul was first made king, what was the first war that he had to deal with? The Ammonites. The Ammonites, the folks in Jabesh-Gilead sent for help. Where's Jabesh-Gilead? Jabesh-Gilead is right there. Israelite city. There was a lot of fighting between Jabesh-Gilead and Israelite city between the Syrians and the Ammonites and the Israelites. They all wanted Jabesh-Gilead. Bad place to live. Wouldn't want to live in Jabesh-Gilead. All right, so that's the reason. So Israel had been, the northern kingdom here had been conquered, deported, and the Ammonites moved in. Now, it's still Israel's territory, and there's still some Israelites here, but they're unable to defend themselves, so Ammon just said, okay, we'll take here, and they just walked in and took over the territory. But it's Israelite territory. So here's what God's going to do. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will cause an alarm of war to be heard in Rabbah of the Ammonites, and it shall be a desolate heap, and her daughter shall be burned with fire. Then shall Israel be heir unto them that were his heirs, saith the Lord. Israel's going to take advantage of this situation. And they did for a little while. Wherefore gloriest thou in thy valleys, thy flowing valley? There were rivers and so on in the region. O backsliding daughter that trustest in her treasures, saying, who shall come unto me? Behold, I will bring fear upon thee, saith the Lord of hosts, from all those that be about thee, and ye shall be driven out every man forth, and none shall gather up him that wandereth. And afterward, again, here you have a promise to the Ammonites. Same thing that was given to the Moabites. And afterward, I will bring again the captivity of the children of Ammon, saith the Lord. Now, what happened to the Ammonites historically? We know they were there when the children of Israel came back from captivity, because they were among the people that were giving Nehemiah a hard time when he was rebuilding the walls. But by the time we get to the Roman period, as an independent people, they're not there anymore. And as far as an ethnic group and stuff, they got assimilated by the surrounding peoples. Are there still descendants of the Ammonites today? Number one, yes, simply because of the number of people, but also it's required because God says he's not done with the Ammonites. So there's got to be a fair number of people out there that are descended from the people that used to live in that region. And matter of fact, they still live in that region. I'm convinced that the people who made up the nation of Moab and the people that made up the nation of Ammon are probably what make up a sizable percentage of the people who are in the modern country of Jordan. Because that area there is now part of Jordan. Both of those nations is part of modern Jordan. All right, so God is not done with the Ammonites. Next one. We come down to Edom, verse 7. Edom had been in this region since the time of Esau. You go to Genesis, Esau went here. And so they had been down here for 1,000 years. Long time. And they're in a pretty secure place, in part because it's so inhospitable. They are amazed. They have, judging from the size of the cities and stuff and archaeological digs, they're astounded at how many people lived there at one point in time. These people had the most amazing water conservation project you can possibly imagine. Just incredible. If you go into Petra today, they've got places, they have catch basins, they have gutters running along the bottoms of the cliffs. And the gutters all run off into cisterns. The hillsides have piles of rocks that are triangular in shape, which funnels, they looked at these things for years and tried to figure, and then they actually tested it and found out it works. They got these piles of rocks, it's like piles of bowling balls. Okay, it's a three-sided pyramid. They've got these things with the point down on the hillsides, and they find that it channels the water to a point. This little pile, and so you could grow a row of grapevines or something below this pile of rocks because it funneled the water. But they had cisterns all over the place in that region so they could grow enough crops to support their population. How many people lived there? Hundreds of thousands of people lived in this region. And you look at, it gets 8 to 10 inches of rain a year. Can you imagine trying to grow crops in the Mojave Desert? It gets about the same amount of rainfall. And there's a few springs in here, but it has to do with the fact that it's a lot more of this than you have in the Mojave. And they took advantage of all the runoff they could possibly get. And they stored all their water. So they were defended because of that. And then also the topography, again, was a benefit. It's very difficult to get in and out of a lot of places in Moab. So, again, they thought they were secure because of their situation. But it says there in verse 7, concerning Moab, thus saith the Lord of hosts, is wisdom no more in Teman? Is counsel perished from the prudent? Is their wisdom vanished? Teman was evidently a place where you could go to for counsel. Perhaps schools of philosophy or so on there, but people went there for wisdom. Teman is mentioned several places in the scripture. Can you think of somebody who was from Teman? If somebody's is from Teman in the Bible, they would be called a Temanite. Anybody can think of somebody who was called a Temanite in the Bible? His name is Eliphaz the Temanite. Who was Eliphaz the Temanite? Let's let you know how old this area is. One of Job's friends. It's Eliphaz the Temanite. So the wisdom, of course, in Job's time, it was a little lacking in wisdom as well. Wisdom is no more in Teman. Counsel is perished. Flee ye, turn back. Dwell deep, O inhabitant of Dedan, for I will bring the calamity of Esau upon him the time that I will visit him. And in the first several verses there, they're going to lose all that they have had. They have spent centuries building up their civilization because, like I said, you had to store everything. It was a very slow process to gain what they had had, and it will be very speedily destroyed. It's the inhabitants of Dedan. Dedan is not part of Edom. Dedan is an Arab city down in this area. And what the prophecy is saying is, folks from Dedan that are up here, that are living here, the expatriates that might be living here for business reasons, Esau is going to get sacked, so you guys better leave town, is what it's saying there. And then it says in verse 9, if grape gatherers had come to thee, would they not leave some gleaning grapes? They didn't strip the vines bare. They would leave a little bit there for the poor and destitute to come through and glean the crops. They did that in Edom as well as in Israel. And if somebody had come, wouldn't they leave some? If thieves by night, will they destroy till they had enough? They can only carry off so much. But I have made Esau bare. I have uncovered his secret places. He shall not be able to hide himself. His seed is spoiled, and his brethren and his neighbors, and he is not. And therefore, they're going to lose all that they had. And the judgment is certain, verse 12. For thus saith the Lord, behold, they whose judgment was not to drink the cup. I don't want to drink this cup of judgment. Shall assuredly be drunken. Art thou he that shall not go, that shall go together, altogether go unpunished? No, you're going to get punished. You can't avoid what is coming. All your counsel, all your plans, everything else is not going to stop, what is going to come from coming. Judgment is certain. Verses 14 through 18, the overthrow will be complete. And then, look at verses, 19 through 22. Behold, he, referring to either Nebuchadnezzar or the Lord, and I'm inclined to think Nebuchadnezzar, he shall come up like a lion from the swelling of Jordan against the inhabitants of the strong. Every year, in the spring of the year, the Jordan would overflow its banks. And the region there is, the levees there are all willow thickets and other things. And in ancient times, up until really Roman times, lions lived in the thickets. There's a lot of wild boar and some other animals that lived in there, and that's where the lions hung out. But in the spring, when it flooded, the lions got driven out of their homes. And so if you lived just above the levee, you had to be very careful in the springtime. Watch out for the lions, okay? The river's flooding, and the lions have been driven out of their lair. And so he's saying here that it's going to be like a lion coming into the land. But I will suddenly make him run away from her. Who is the chosen man that I will... Am I reading the right place? Yes. Who is the chosen man that I may appoint over her? Who is like me? And who will appoint me the time? And who is the shepherd that will stand before me? Therefore, hear the counsel of the Lord that he hath taken against Moab and his purposes. He hath purposed against the inhabitants of Teman. Surely the least of the flock shall draw them out. Surely he will make their inhabitants desolate with him. The earth is moved at the noise of their fall. At the cry of the noise, therefore, was heard at the dead in the dead in the Red Sea, some distance away. Behold, he shall come up and fly as the eagle, spread his wings over Bozrah, another city. And at that time shall the heart of the mighty men of Edom be as the pangs of the heart of a woman in her pangs. What you've got here is that they're going to be driven from their land. Now, what happened to the Moabites, or the Edomites rather? What happened to these folks is, after the collapse of Moab, the Arabs, the Nabataeans, moved in. Well, these folks here were also conquered and weakened, severely weakened by the Chaldeans. And so they moved in there as well. This region became the Nabataean kingdom combined, which existed, that was in existence during the time of Christ. As a matter of fact, in the New Testament era, it went all the way up to Damascus, covered this whole region here. This was Roman. This was Nabataean. Damascus was under the Nabataeans when Paul escaped in a basket over the wall, when King Aretas, who was the Nabataean king, sought to get it. So these folks here just got assimilated. The Moabites just got assimilated into this. What happened to the Edomites? Something very different. By the way, there's no promise of a future here for the Edomites. What happened to them? What happened to them? They're driven from their land. Where'd they go? They came over here. Down into the Negev, the area, the desolate area in southern Israel. Between the Testaments, between the Old and New Testaments, you had a lot of different things happen. And you had a time, about 150 years or so, a little bit more than that, where you had a group of people called the Maccabees. Who are the Maccabees? Who are the Maccabees? Okay, it's a family. Yeah, Judas Maccabeus. They're the ones that defeated Antiochus. They brought back the temple worship that had been desecrated. This is why you have Hanukkah and so on. All right, the Maccabees came in, and they overthrew their Greek oppressors, and they set up an independent Jewish kingdom. But it wasn't under the Davidic throne. It was under the rule of the Maccabee family. And because the folks up here were weak and because the folks down here in Egypt were weak, they expanded their power. And over a period of generations, they conquered the Samaritans and destroyed the Samaritan temple that was at Mount Gerizim, which is one of the reasons why the Samaritans hated the Jews. And still do. And they also conquered the folks that had moved in down here. Now, by the time you get to the Maccabee period, these people are now called Idumeans. They're not called Edomites anymore, they're called Idumeans. Same people, just changed their name. And when the Maccabees conquered the Idumeans, they made them convert to Judaism. And they became assimilated into the Jewish nation. Anybody we know of that was an Idumean in New Testament times? Famous family was Idumean, but primarily in their heritage. The family of a guy named Herod. The Herods were Idumeans. Now, are there still Edomites? Almost certainly. But the Edomites, as a people, are actually in the mix of people that would identify themselves today as Jews, because they were forced to embrace Judaism. And the Herods, even for all their wickedness, were practicing Jews. And they had been for a couple of hundred years by the time we get to the New Testament era. All right? We'll call it quits there. Any questions on what we've looked at? I know this is meticulous little historical stuff. Yes? For what? I don't think the whole thing lasted even 200 years. The first two generations were pretty sharp people, and then it deteriorated from there. They were also, the Maccabees were priests, were Levites. They were a priestly family.
Yeah, so it was about three generations.
A little bit more than that. And how Herod got into it is he married Miriam, who was the last of the Maccabees. And that's how he got it. He married into this. And then went and talked to the Romans and said, hey, I got my foot in the door. Can I have your authority to do thus and such? And they said, sure. And so he became a client king. Roman authorization, which meant he had Rome behind him. And that's how he gained power and then passed it on to his family. All right. Let's go ahead and close in prayer. Father, we're thankful that you have a purpose for all these things. And Father, it's very interesting that we're dealing with peoples that we read about in the Old Testament. They're not even, some of them are not even recorded in the New Testament. And yet, for some of these folks, you have a future purpose for them. And Father, sometimes we don't know why from your word you have a purpose for these, but we know that the Moabites and the Ammonites will be back in their land during the millennium. And Father, evidently worshiping and serving you as they should have from the get-go, having had the knowledge of the Most High from Lot. So Father, we thank you for the information you've given us. Help us to understand that you indeed are in control. And even though these people are not discernible in the world today, they are still there. And you know who's who, and you will assign them their portion in the latter days. Thank you for your wisdom, your knowledge, that you and your control, that you will do all that you have said. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.